My name is Suzanne Narducci, and I live in San Clemente, California. I'm here today with my good friend Lee McMorris, who is a friend for over 30 years. We are recording this interview in Irvine, California. Lee, would you like to tell us a little about your family?
Well, what I wanted to do is really tell about the happiest moment of my life.
Oh, I would be interested to hear that.
And that is when, in 1982, I lived in Riverside at that time. I live right now in Laguna Woods, California. But back in 1982, I was living in Riverside, California. It was a very hot September day, very hot September evening. And my best friend at that time was sitting with me, and I got a phone call. And when I picked up the phone, there was kind of a slight cough, and then a man's voice said, I think I'm your half brother. And then I shouted, Sells McMorris? He said, yes. And that's when I met my half brother. We were both over 40, and he was 9 years older than I. And I kind of waved at my friend and picked up the phone and went back to my bedroom and spent the next hour going over who he was, where he'd come from, how he found me. And he found me because when my father passed away, he had left a note in his will that I would get a bequest of about $5,000 if I could be found within 6 months. So my brother, being the conscientious book nerd that I found out that he was, he went to the New York Public Library, because he lived in Brooklyn and the best library was at the New York Public Library, went to their telephone book section, which had telephone books from all over, and proceeded to look for McMorris, M-A-C-M-O-R-R-I-S, in all the phone books starting with Alaska. Fortunately, he did it in alphabetical order. So he said he should have really not bothered with Alaska. But when he got to California, it was about the fifth phone call he'd made, because he didn't know whether it was going to be listed under Lucy, which is my check signing signature, or under Lee, or how it was going to be listed. In fact, I don't think he knew the name Lee at that time. But anyway, he looked for L. McMorris or something, and what the miracle of it was that I had not changed my name. Because if I had married or taken another name, we would have never connected. So that was one of the great things. The other marvelous thing was that mine had always been a very nuclear family, and it was very nuclear because my father was out of the picture from the time I was 4 years old. And it was my mother, my grandfather, and me. And my grandfather passed away shortly after I graduated from high school. And my mother had passed away about 4 years before this date. So I was an orphan.
And prior to this phone call, did you know of your brother?
Yes, I did. And my mother had told me about him because she used to buy Christmas gifts for him, for my father. So, yeah, she knew about him, and she told me about him. But I don't know that she had ever met him either. So the big thing was I had no family, but I sort of had, you know, the wonderful thing is that you can sometimes, when you don't have a family, bring your family to you. And that way you really get to pick the best. So I had my neighbor in back was a deaf couple. He had worked as a teacher for the local school for the deaf in Riverside. We had met, and they were just charming people. And they taught me some sign language. They could read lips quite well. So that became my mother and father, so to speak. Their sons became the brothers I would love to have had because they were both retired West Point graduates, retired as full colonels. No, one was a full colonel, one is a light colonel in the Army. So I had family there, and I had girlfriends, a couple of girlfriends that became sisters in a sense to me. So I didn't feel lonely. I didn't feel I needed a family. So I think when you become quite comfortable with what you have, then what you have missed is brought to you. And this is what my brother did. Now, we talked about him. Now, this is September. We talked about him coming out in January. But then he gave me a call 2 days later and said, I can't wait. I've got to come. So he came out in time for Thanksgiving, for our Thanksgiving. And wouldn't you know, this was the Thanksgiving in which we got all the rain. It wasn't a good California Christmas time at all, or holiday time, or Thanksgiving time, rather. And when I picked him up, I didn't realize, because my car was an old car and the gas gauge had gone out on it, I didn't realize, and I had to guesstimate how much gas I had in the car by the number of miles. But this call and all about it, it so turned me upside down that I wasn't thinking about what was in my car. And on the way back from LAX, my car slowly died because it ran out of gas. It's 11:30 at night on a dark road west of Riverside in the countryside. I pull over at the side. Of course, this is the time we don't have phones, you know, cell phones at that time. I look around and wondering, what on earth am I going to do? Well, I had stopped, and I looked off to my left. There was a farmhouse out in the middle of a field with a light on at the door, a light on at the door. So I thought, well, all I can do. So I left my poor brother there in the car, and I walked down to the house. Rang the doorbell, and a man came out who was somewhat unshaven. He said, out of gas.
I said, yes. Like this was something common for that family.
That exactly is it. He said, you're not the only one. So bless his heart, he let me use his phone. I called AAA. 45 minutes later, they were there. Not exactly instant, but at least close enough. By the time my poor brother got to bed, it was 2:30 in the morning. Well, I found out I couldn't really talk that much to my brother because a lot of the interests that I had, he didn't have. It was not his. He was a different person from what I had hoped would be. And so it was not easy. However, I was invited for Christmas. And I went to meet people that I knew then were my family, because my niece turned out to be someone who shared interests with me. And I thought, well, this is genetic proof. We do share interests. She was she had a love of Egyptology, and I had too. I had a passion for it when I was younger. In fact, that's what she was studying at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She ended up being a baker. I'm a cook. I don't like to bake, but she was good in both ends. She married a wonderful Italian husband when he was 20 and she was 18. And so I met them. She at that time had a young son, two children, one baby, one slightly older. One of them is now a reporter for Vice News, which is on cable. So I get to see him periodically on there. But they brought me my family.
Yes.
What a marvelous thing. So it back and forth. And the traits that I find difficult in her are my traits. Same things I have problems with. So one of the things families often, you try and communicate with them, and she doesn't return calls. Fortunately, I can get a hold of her through her husband, so this is nice. So, but now I've had this family, and then I was introduced to more members of the family. So I found out one of the in-laws, her mother's, her mother's, Mary's mother's family was quite large. There were several children. In about a 20-year space, the children were born. So you had one that was very old who passed away shortly thereafter, and a couple of them that are around now. What becomes interesting about it is that then I don't meet the West Coast family that lives up in the Portland area. I don't meet them until about 3 years ago. I see pictures of them because he and his family would visit the North Carolina family. It ended up being an absolutely fascinating time. And one of the comforting things is, yes, they're 3,000 miles apart. But it doesn't matter, because with a phone, you can reach them. And it's more likely to be a text or a short email, but at least it's contact. And it's a family. I would have loved to have known them earlier, though.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's what happened there. But I sort of feel I've had a very fortunate life, because I think that I got my family, my second family, at a time that was very good for me. It was good, it made me feel so good and so, it was an adventure. Because to blend into another family is an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What fun. So that's that story. I feel, a very fortunate life. I've made very good friends, of which you are one. I consider you my best friend.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The feeling is mutual.
Thank you very much. Yeah, really. And I got to do... And I was able to seize on possibilities and adventures when I could afford them. I always wanted to travel, always wanted to go to school in England, managed that with a scholarship to Reading University. Then afterward, I wanted to travel most awfully. And a marvelous adventure in France on a motorized bicycle. I stayed with some Red Cross workers when we had an airfield in France before de Gaulle threw them out. And I met some Red Cross women who did Red Cross work in Japan and Korea. And they did Red Cross work in Korea, and they'd come in before these Red Cross workers came in before they had the special service, military special services or recreation services. So they kind of broke the barrier for that. So I met them, decided I wanted to be able to tell war stories like theirs, because theirs were fascinating and funny.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the sort of women I wanted to be. I wanted to be that type of person.
And how old were you then?
I was 22.
So you were still very young.
Oh, yeah. My gosh, yes. Because I came out of college at 22, went to University of Reading in England, went to France in the springtime, and met these people, then met these marvelous Red Cross workers, recreation workers. Got back home. Oh, and during the time I was in Reading, I went to work for an outfit called the Carol Jenner Mobile Children's Theater. And, oh, that's my phone. Okay. Oh, we've got... No, we have... No. Okay.
That's good. So you mentioned earlier in your dissertation of your life that your father left the family when you were four.
Yeah.
Do you know why he left the family? Were your parents divorced then?
When I was four, that would be about 1938, 39, about four. I think he wanted to go back to Kansas City. That was his roots, really. He was an artist and very well known, did work, and mother met him when he had been doing some work in New York. He would do murals, portraits, but he was not, at that time he was doing murals around. And so I think he was going back to Kansas City. His mother was there, and that was a very close relationship. It beat the relationship he had with my mother.
And where were you with your mother and your grandfather living at that point?
Well, my grandfather wasn't with us then. This was prior to the time my grandfather joined us. And you were asked...
Where you and your mother lived.
We were in New York City.
Okay.
And my father had been doing work there and so that was finished, so he was going back to Kansas City. And I think he wanted maybe mother to come with him, but she didn't want to. Her work was in New York because she was working for a magazine. As a writer, so she was primarily a writer during her life. But so he left, and for all practical purposes, they divorced. I think someplace along the line there, don't know.
Okay, so let's backtrack for a minute.
Yeah,
you said that your brother is 9 years older than you are.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, my father married three times.
Okay.
And the first time he married. The woman he married had some mental problems, and the family, however, is very wealthy. They wanted to have their daughter married. Why specifically, I wasn't quite sure. So they financed my father's about 2 to 3 years of art school in Paris. And so they were there for 2 years. And when they came back, I don't know, There are great gaps in my father's life, as far as I'm concerned, anyway. And someplace along the line, he divorced her. This was in the 1920s, and 30s, and he met my mother, and I think I was born in 34.
But that first marriage produced your brother.
The first marriage produced my brother. Okay. Yeah, right. And unfortunately, she was schizophrenic and was in the and had to be hospitalized in a very expensive place in Connecticut. And so my brother, I guess, was, I'm not certain whether he, I'm not, no, I think he was with his grandfather. And that... For all of this was a very wealthy family, so there's no question of any poverty or any being poor at all. Mother, however, was effectively a single parent, with also grandfather who joined, and he was very good to have as a because he'd been born in Sweden. He had escaped Sweden. I say escaped because his grandmother, another wealthy family, escaped from Sweden. He was, in a sense, financed to run away on a ship from Sweden to New York in 1880. Because my father, my great-grandfather, was a German attaché to Sweden. And he was a peculiar man. His jewelry was only made of iron. He was peculiar. But he was also probably abusive. And abusive probably to my grandfather, so That's why my grandmother assisted. So I don't know anything about my great-grandmother. I know very little about that part of the family. So anyway, so that's that. So he married his first wife, and I don't know, let's see. Well, he married my grandmother. First grandmother. And then she was put away into a whole, into the mental home. Then he divorced her, married, and I'm not sure whether he ever married my mother. Because in the biography that I found, there's no mention of her.
Have you ever tried to look it up? Maybe that would be a good thing to check with.
Yeah, but why?
Does it matter? I don't know.
It doesn't really matter anymore.
Okay.
No, and especially not now.
Yes.
Because a lot of us who are the other side of the bed type, marriages. So he left. Mother made good money when she was in New York. When we moved to Upper New York State because of the war that was going on, World War II, New York had there were a lot of rumors circulating around New York, so she felt it was a good idea to leave. So she found a position as a writer for a cosmetic direct sales outfit operating out of Newark, New York. And it was a very, very good, very profitable little thing. The town was a town of about 10,000. So you had small town. And when Mother got there, she worked, I think, for the man who hired her was the president of the company. He passed away approximately 8 months after she arrived. And there was a big shakeup in the company, and she was let go.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. So she worked in retail then, because what she had dealt with much of her life was clothing, was writing about clothing, cosmetics, and all of this. And so she managed to educate me and all. We moved when I graduated from high school. I graduated from Daycroft School in Connecticut, which was a wonderful school, we moved back to New York when I was a senior in high school. And Mother found a scholarship for me to Daycroft School, and that's where I went. And Mother said the nicest thing that she ever got was a letter that I sent to her, because there were all these boys and girls who came from, I wrote her, I said, we have all these people come from broken families, and it's so sad. Never mentioned the fact that I, too, was a product of a broken family. And I never felt it, because I never felt it. I never felt it at all. I never felt neglected. I never felt any angst on the part of my my mother. My grandfather was highly supportive, so it was wonderful. My grandfather passed away while we were in New York on the time we returned, because Mother came back to New York to help my godmother write a book. My mother was the editor. Then when my grandfather passed away, we were between jobs, say my godmother and my godmother, and effectively moved us out to Kansas. And so that's where I went to college, to a junior college there in the Hutchinson, Kansas, which is a superb junior college, because it fed, its students went to the University of Kansas, which was an excellent school.
Did you ever think to look up your father when you were back in Kansas?
Yes, I did. But not when I was living in Hutchinson, Kansas, nor because I was going to junior college there. Because he was in Kansas City. He lived in Kansas City. I wasn't When you don't have a car, and train travel isn't all that frequent or comfortable in that part of the world, it isn't in your list of possibilities. But when I was a senior in college, I thought, I think I'm going to try and get hold of it. And I have never felt so anxious or scared. Not scared. What is it? I called him. Phone rang. And I reached him. And so we agreed that I would come up to see him. And he lived in a lovely part of Kansas City, a big old house with a Midwest huge porch on it. Walk in a big old comfortable house. But my conversation with him was the most stilted thing I think I'd ever gone through. It was the biggest disappointment because his wife was there, his third wife was there. And she, I don't know, maybe it was a second, no, it was the third wife. And she sat in a sense between us. It was a triangle. And she sat sort of midway as though she were officiating a tennis game. And went back. She was just all tight and wrapped up in herself and looking fiercely. So it was a very, very cold meeting. I never saw him after that.
Did you ever speak to him after that?
No, never did.
That was it?
That was it. Didn't want to. Mm. Didn't want to them. But I felt it so badly. Fortunately, at that time, I was in theater. So theater's a good place to work out some of your stuff. And so I wrote a play. I was in a playwriting class because that was part of the theater, because I was a theater, an English major. Ended up with more theater stuff than English. And so I wrote a play about this, and I wrote what I would like to have said to him had I had the guts at the time or even the mental acuity to do it at the time. That helped.
That sounds cathartic.
It was. It was cathartic. Thank heaven for that. I don't know what I did with it. I think I probably shredded it someplace. But that was that. And then after that, that's when I was 14, I think I made a list of things that I wanted to do. One of them is I wanted to go to England. I wanted to go to school. I wanted to go to Oxford University. That's what I did. And Oxford University application form is very long. And I filled it up. We sent it in. And no way that I could get in with that. So I tried. Fortunately, they had there at the university, they had a German professor, who facilitated students to go to various universities in Europe. He worked on them. He worked with me for 2 years on this thing. And so we tried getting in, I think I've got that very wrong, in Germany, and we tried a couple of France, we tried a couple of others, and all of them came back. And so I was all set to go on to a master's program in speech, speech therapy. And it was graduation day. And I got a call from the dean's office. And he went there and he said, you've been given a scholarship to the University of Reading. Now, Reading is chartered by Oxford, mm-hmm. University of Oxford. So I thought, now that's interesting. That had been my dream wish to do. So it ended up I went to University of Reading, and how we did that, I don't know. I think we borrowed some money, and I think part of it I was financed partly by the newspaper if I would write them articles on it. And I did, but not that many, and they compiled all of them, I think, into one bit. But it was fairly interesting, so... So that's how I got my year in England. Mm. And from England, I spent Christmas as a cook for a British-American family. I say British-American. The husband was British. The wife was American. and they were osteopaths. They had a very nice house, and they had their own garden, and this is where I was introduced to fresh Brussels sprouts, which is very different from what we get in the market, because they are not bitter. Brussels sprouts are bitter to me.
You need the babies.
That's what we got. That's exactly what we got.
The babies are more tender and flavorful.
Oh, they
are. The older they get, the more bitter they get.
Oh, and so true. So that was 4 weeks that I spent as a cook. I loved that. I was a cook for a British family, and I knew how to cook. Not great, but good. And so went back to school, finished the next term. And then for the summer, I thought, I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do if I want to stay? And I managed to get hired sort of under the table, because I had to have work permits. You had to have work permits. So they've hired me. And I stayed then with this Carol Jenner Mobile Theater, Children's Theater. They traveled all around England putting on plays. And I worked in their scenic department, helping to paint scenery and do stuff like this for the summer. And then went back home. Got back home. And I went to work for Barry Goldwater's. I think that was what was at that time, I'm thinking. And then at that time also, I had put in my application to go to Korea with American Red Cross because of the friendships I'd made there. So I ended up in Korea. My experience with Red Cross as a recreation worker enabled me to become a recreation worker for Army. And so after Korea, I went to Alaska, was there for 2.5 years in the center of Alaska. And the center of that area was the largest, probably the largest piece of land, because it was a cold weather testing region. A very small base, a very large piece of land, and they could test artillery, we would never hear it. But I helped to break their... I helped to mess up their ski trail because they were cold weather training center. And I learned that older skiers don't break as many bones as younger ones do. Because the young lieutenants and captains would come in and they'd learn about this thing and they'd speed down and they'd break their legs. But the older ones were a lot more cautious. So you never saw casts on the colonels. So after that, I got hired for a position as a recreation center director, community center director, I think they started calling them then, in northeast Montana. And she said, the woman who was, she was the first female recreation director for Air Force, and this was an Air Force base, a SAC base. And the reason she hired me was because I had put down my reason for leaving Alaska was to go to a less isolated spot. And as she said when she got off the floor after having laughed herself silly, because northeast Montana, I was 110 miles from any city in either direction, 250 miles from a city of any consequence. The towns were about 10,000 on either side of a 110-mile road straight across Montana.
And yet you were enticed to go there.
And I was enticed to go there. Yes, you're absolutely right. But one of the reasons I was enticed was because I got a grade advance, grade level. And so then 18 months later, Mike Mansfield, Senator Mansfield, who had given Northeast Montana, that base, was informed that they were closing many of the bases that had opened up because it was a reduction in force. and they just didn't need all the places that they had, so they closed this base in northeast Montana, and I got an opportunity to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. That's when I called my mother one February afternoon and said, "Want to go to Japan? Want to live in Japan?" "Yes," she said. I said, "Mother, did you realize I'm saying, would you like to move to Japan?" She said, "I heard you." "Yes." And so my mother and I, because John Kennedy had finally declared that women, civilians who worked for the army or on all, could have dependents. They acknowledged that they had dependents, and as such, could take them overseas.
So you claimed your mother as a dependent.
Oh, yeah, and she was. She was. Yeah. And so we spent close to 6 years there. And she had a wonderful time because she really studied the art, the people. And she ended up being a teacher of some of the... We lived in a little town called Hakata, which was across the bay from the city of Fukuoka, which is in the southern island of Kyushu. And she ended up being a teacher for some of the Fukuoka municipal officers. So that was good for her. And I was going to help her. I was going to try to, because, you know, she hadn't done anything like this in years and years and years. If ever, says I. So I sat on the stairs and I listened to her and I realized, oh, Lee, you don't teach her anything. You don't need to. And she should teach you. So she was excellent. She was an excellent teacher. So then after 6 years, you're supposed to return in 5 years, but I kind of overstayed it. And one of the things I'd always said is, I would never live in California. No, I didn't want to live in California. In fact, most of the things I say I would never do, I ended up doing. And this was one of them. And so more than half my life has been lived in California, and I'm pleased to death with the choice. So this is sort of where I came. I worked at March Air Force Base. Then I worked after that, after 13 years at March Air Force Base, I went to work at L.A. Air Force Base. Now, the only hangars at L.A. Air Force Base are in the closet, because it really is it's an odd thing. They have more civilians than officers and more officers than enlisted on that base, because it negotiates with the aircraft industry. It's right in the center of it there. So I had that for about 2 years, 2.5, 3 years, then retired. Then went back to school.
Of course you did.
Yes. And got a library degree because I've always been in love with books. And I had an opportunity to do it, and I paid my way with credit card and money to get the things, and did part-time work. And so that's how I ended up as a full career. I had 27 years in with Air Force and an Army, and about 25 years in with libraries. Two careers.
And for anyone listening to this who are trying to add up all your jobs and all the years you were in your jobs, enlighten your audience as to how old you are and how old you will be, rather, on Saturday, the 24th.
Ah, yes. Well, I retired when I was 81. I'm 85 right now. So I ended up as a research librarian for Abbott Medical Optics, which was absolutely fascinating career. And I was able to do all the things I'd always wanted to do, which is when computers and searching and all of that came in, I thought what a fabulous thing it would be to be able to sit one place and access information and libraries everywhere, which is what you can do now.
Yes.
So I was able to do that. As I say, I've had a very fortunate life. And I've been fortunate in the friends I've known, in the support that I've received, in my very close relations, because I lived with a wonderful person for about 15 years and was introduced to him by another man whom I stayed with for about 3 years. And he passed away, and his friend said that he'd been charged with making certain I was okay. So I ended up being very okay. Hmm. It's been a fun life. It's been fun to do the things you wanted to do, to live in the places. Because I felt when I do normal travel, it's like looking at postcards. I don't really absorb it. I only absorb it if I live there. And I was fortunate enough to live in some places for a while, get to know that. It's nice to be able to feel a wrench when you have to leave a place that it's been that good for you. And in nearly every place it was. And we're getting down close to the end of our recording time.
I see that. So to end this conversation, may I wish you the happiest of 86th birthdays.
85th. It's my 85th.
You said you were 85 to now.
Well, I know, but I'm shortly there.
Oh, I'm you're turning 80. You're turning 85.
Yes, right.
Well, happy 85th birthday on Saturday, August the 24th, 2019.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. I do see my dear friend. It's been a delight pouring out my life story to you.
And I've enjoyed listening to some of your little stories I was not even aware of, even knowing you for 30 years. Pretty amazing.
Actually, we need to talk more about what we've done. I find out that memories fade if we don't start talking about them.
It's true.
Okay.
But you will go down for all perpetuity now because you have recorded the story of your life.
And you have interviewed it, so you will go down in perpetuity as well. Yay!